Good morning. I'm Mark Reilly here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Good morning, folks. It's 6 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Reilly. Mark Maron is off today. He is not gone. He has not been fired. I want to make sure we start out this morning. I'll tell you, each of you, at the top of each hour, that no, Maron is just out until Tuesday. He will be back. Want to say a special good morning today to postal workers, especially those getting off the graveyard shift this morning. Good morning to late night party people. You know who you are. You're on your way home in various states of sobriety. Want to say good morning to people who make their living on or from the water, whether it be a river, the ocean, the sea, whatever. People who love horses, good morning. Let's say good morning to deli counter people who are probably just waking up, rubbing the sleep out of their eyes on their way in to make some what the deli counter? Oh, that's right. They make like scrambled eggs and bacon and those big monstrous looking things that people eat every morning. Good morning, Brendan McDonald.
Good morning, Riley.
I saw your lovely wife at the O'Neill's gig yesterday.
Right. That was her coming out party.
Mrs. McDonald.
Spouse. Yeah.
Is she keeping her maiden name at all? Is she doing the hyphen thing?
For her career, she's keeping her name, but I guess legally on the bills and whatnot, she's.
It'll be McDonald.
There we go.
There you go. Well. Look at you. Let's say good morning to John Cremings as well. How you doing?
Morning, Riley.
I know it's been a long night for you.
Yeah, it was.
It was. Well, as soon as we're done here, go home and get yourself some sleep, all right?
Thanks.
Some rest. Want to thank everyone who came out to O'Neill's yesterday. Man, people sitting on the floor of O'Neill's yesterday morning, man. It was something else. Great gathering, great lot of fun, great last live remote broadcast. But it was not the last broadcast, okay? Let's be very clear about that. I would say good morning to President George W. Bush, but as they say in Brooklyn, he ain't here. He's in Argentina, Mar del Plata, Argentina, for an America's Trade Summit. And they're not showing him a whole heck of a lot of love down there south of the border. In fact, there are thousands of people that are demonstrating and massing to demonstrate against President George W. Bush. And guess what they're massing to demonstrate against? That he's done. The war in Iraq. What else? This is exactly. See, you go around the world and you don't see the tremendous groundswell of support. Of course, you don't see it here either. But the tremendous groundswell of support for this war in Iraq that maybe Bush had when he first started, and the political capital he got in the last election has been spent here, and people abroad know it's been spent here. So there's no love for George W. Bush in Argentina. He's also going to Brazil and Panama, and then he's going to Asia on top of that. The man, this must be the get-away from it all tour before my friends all get locked up. Scooter Libby, you remember him. He showed up in court yesterday, crutches and all, and he also showed up loaded for bear at his arraignment. Ted Wells and William Jeffress are his attorneys, and they are apparently some of the very, very best at getting white-collar alleged criminals off. In fact, one of them worked on Raymond Donovan's case. Ray Donovan, of course, was a labor secretary who about 20-some-odd years ago was indicted and charged with corruption. He was acquitted. He was the guy who made the world-famous statement, "Where do I go to get my reputation back?" after he was acquitted on the steps of the courthouse there. So, of course, Libby's got these two guys. And word is, he's going to mount a very aggressive defense. He believes he's innocent. Now, the problem for the White House in Libby doing this is that they're going to end up calling a whole bunch of people from the inside of the Bush administration, from inside the Bush administration, and they're going to have to get up and testify in open court. Dick Cheney can't claim the Fifth, folks. He's the vice president. I mean, he could theoretically as a citizen, but it would be rather unseemly if Dick Cheney, vice president of the United States, got up at a Scooter Libby trial and either took the Fifth Amendment or started redacting stuff saying it was all classified or that he couldn't comment on the investigation because it was ongoing. That was Scott McClellan's favorite thing while Fitzgerald was still doing his work. The fact of the matter is, Libby's trial will be an outright embarrassment. By the way, not just in the U.S., a worldwide embarrassment for the Bush administration. Make no mistake about that. We're going to jump very quickly over to what used to be called Gay Paris. No longer. Paris is burning, folks. At least the suburbs of Paris are. African and other minority youth have been out on the streets for over a week at this point. I believe if it goes on tonight, it'll be the eighth consecutive day. Reports are saying that this is not frustration over an allegation of police brutality. What happened was that two African Afro-French youth were electrocuted, and the word on the street was that they were electrocuted because police chased them into a shed that was very dangerous, and that's where they died. And that supposedly triggered the violence, but now reports are saying that the violence is not just about that singular act, but it is boiled over frustration over, guess what, not having work. You'd be really surprised, ladies and gentlemen, how these themes keep repeating themselves all over the world. When people do not have gainful employment, when people cannot make a living, when people cannot afford to feed their existing family or one that they plan on making sometime in the future, frustration tends to set in. And that's why you're seeing some of the things that you see going on in Paris and in other places across the world that we don't always hear so much about. Of course, you know, the officials in France are calling for calm, calling for people to please, you know, don't go back out in the street. One of the people involved in the French cabinet kind of threw gas on the fire, talking about going in and cleaning out certain neighborhoods. And, of course, you know, that's like waving a red flag in front of a bull. Why would you say that to people? These are folks who are angry and who are upset. Now, nobody condones violence. I don't condone violence. I don't like violence. I don't even like guns, okay? I don't like any implement of violence. Violence is something that is anathema to me. But I do understand why people become violent as a way to try and get them to stop being violent. One of the things that, you know, and this violence could simply spend itself over time. In many instances, riots going back in history have simply been allowed to spend themselves. The draft riots here in New York, for example, in 1863, just spent themselves. People got tired of, you know, killing folks and torching buildings, and that was the end of that. And maybe that's what will happen here, but there are some root causes to this violence in Paris. And by the way, there is also the question of alienation of many of these youth. Some of them are African, some of them are Middle Eastern, some of them are Asian. But the fact of the matter is they are all frustrated by the same common thread. They don't feel as if they are part of any unified France. Just like we have trouble here in the States sometimes putting together a national identity, an identity that says, you know, we are Americans. And that means all of us, regardless of our skin color or whatever, the different things that divide us. So often it ends up being money and, you know, class structure in this country. I'm not a communist or anything, but facts are facts. That's the way the country divides itself, and that's the way people benefit by the country being divided. And that's what's going on in France as well. And there has to be some acknowledgement of it, some recognition of it, and some steps taken to make it better. That is, I think, what you're supposed to be doing in that instance. We're going to jerk real quick back to the United States because Karl Rove is in the news. Been in the news for the last couple of days because there are now shutters and rumors inside the White House that Karl Rove's time may be up, no matter whether he is indicted or not. Are there people inside the Bush administration looking to push Karl Rove over the edge? He's been caught in an out-and-out lie about outing Valerie Plame, okay? Matt Cooper said it was Karl Rove that did this. Karl Rove and Scott McClellan, the rest of these people, McClellan must want to cut Karl Rove's off because he was the one in 2003. He was the one that got up and said, oh, no. Karl Rove had nothing whatsoever to do with the leaking of Valerie Plame's name. We now know that he did. Now, that may not be an indictable offense. Maybe it's not. Maybe the fact that he lied to a grand jury. I'm pretty sure he lied to a grand jury about what his knowledge was of Valerie Plame's status and who he spoke to about Valerie Plame. He lied about that, but let's say that's not a crime. Let's say that's not an indictable offense. Why would you keep this guy in your White House? Why would you keep this guy who got caught up in this kind of contradiction, in this kind of seemingly out-and-out lie? And I'm sure they'll find some way to make it sound different than, a lapse of memory or vague consciousness or whatever they call this sort of thing. But he was lying. The man was lying, pure and simple. And then the question is, and I'm not the only one asking it, what the hell is he doing this close to the seat of power in this country? We are going to come back in a moment and talk about this Italy thing, the yellow cake Italy connection, and a guy named Rocco Martino who's at the center of it all. It's 16 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation today. He'll be on vacation again on Monday. He will be back with us on Tuesday. Later this morning, we're going to be talking with Etan Thomas. He's going to be joining us by phone. He is a ball player with the Washington Wizards, and he is, in my judgment, a throwback. What do I mean by that? He is a throwback to a time when athletes spoke out forcefully on issues that affected not just them, but the world. So we're going to be talking with him about that. He's got a book of poetry. He's a really deep young man. Also this morning, Congresswoman Maxine Waters from Los Angeles, California, is going to be joining us on the phone. She will not be in Los Angeles. She'll be in our nation's capital. She'll get us up to speed on exactly what's going on down there these days. Zach Goldsmith, editor of The Ecologist magazine, will also be joining us in studio. This magazine is making a lot of noise over in the UK, and it is launching this month here in the good old USA. Later on today, I'm going to be on New York One. Those of you in the New York area, I will be on the road to City Hall at 7:30 this evening. And I want to make sure that all of you have the opportunity to communicate. If you're of a mind, our number, 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. Whatever's on your mind. It's Friday, man. You know, and I know that not everything on your mind is political. If it's not, you know, you got something wrong with your iPod or something, call too. 866-303-2270. We're going to get into a really deep story about now. This is one of these stories that takes, how best to put this, a little bit of parsing. It takes a little bit of explaining, because it is one of these stories that were it not for the work of a number of different people, we probably would not have known about the lengths to which the Bush administration went, and other governments, by the way, went to try and put us all on the on-ramp to the war in Iraq. We're talking about now Italy, where they have been doing a closed-door parliamentary investigation of the whole Niger yellow cake fiasco, which the Italian intelligence agency played a role in. That Italian intelligence agency is acronymed SISMI, S-I-S-M-I. And don't ask me what that is in Italian, but they were involved in apparently receiving information about the Yellow Cake Memo, which they later told the United States, by the way, in January of 2003. And it's interesting, they don't know whether it was before or after Bush's State of the Union address, but they say that in January 2003, Italian intelligence warned the U.S. before the war in Iraq that the Niger stuff on the part of Saddam Hussein, and for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about in terms of yellow cake, this was an allegation that Saddam Hussein had tried to purchase yellow cake uranium, which is one of the baby steps in making a nuclear bomb, from the African nation of Niger. And now it turns out, first of all, we know and have known for a while that those documents were complete and utter forgeries. Several intelligence agencies, allegedly including the CIA, our own CIA, said it was fake. Yet still, it managed to find its way into George W. Bush's January 03 State of the Union address, where he ramped out and put out the reasons why America needed to intervene militarily in Iraq. Now, let's get down to a guy by the name of Rocco Martino, who we mentioned a few days ago, actually. Rocco Martino is apparently an occasional spy. How do you end up being an occasional spy. You know, you spy in your spare time. You work in an auto parts store or something, and you collect intelligence data about what people are. I don't know how you're an occasional spy. I do know that earlier reports I saw said that Rocco Martino was largely in this. This is speculation on my part. I don't know this to be true. But that Rocco Martino was in this essentially for the money, okay? That he wanted to get some dough out of this whole thing. And by the way, the Italians are now saying that Rocco Martino alleged that he was working for the government of, guess who? France! That's right. The French, who didn't get on the ramp anyway. I mean, the French were one of the most vocal opponents of the Iraq invasion. But now Rocco Martino said that all this document passing may have been on behalf of the French intelligence agency. But be that as it may, this guy Martino apparently was the one who passed this information on. And the Italian intelligence chief is not saying that Rocco Martino was the one who forged the documents himself. All they're saying is he passed them along. Now, what does that mean? It possibly means, because there's been widespread speculation about exactly who wrote these documents up in the first place. They've traced it back to a break-in, a burglary, at the Niger embassy in Rome back in 01, where apparently nothing was taken but a watch and some stationery. And there's been widespread speculation, slow down, Riley, that it was, in fact, those pieces of stationery that were used to make these forged documents, which apparently you could have sussed out by going on Google and looking for a couple of hours or so. I don't know why American intelligence didn't figure that out and how it got into Bush's State of the Union, but hey, we quibble here. Rocco Martino apparently was one of the central figures, and I don't know, and I'm not sure that the Italian intelligence people know if Martino knew that they were forgeries in the first place, and we don't yet know exactly who he got the documents from, but we do know he was central in passing them on. Now, the other problem with this story is the following. Italian intelligence isn't exactly hewing to a straight line on exactly what happened here. They are now saying they didn't even pass the documents on to the U.S., yet we do know that the documents passed through the U.S. Embassy in Rome, straight to Washington, without being vetted, as is usually the case, by folks inside the U.S. Embassy. How all that happened? How did all this intrigue take place? I don't know. But we need to get to the bottom of it, and justice needs to be done. Boy, when we come back, we're going to talk about attack ads and the mother of all attack ads coming to us from the great state of New Jersey. Stay with us. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour, it's morning sedition. Good morning if you're just waking up. You can breathe a sigh of relief. George W. Bush is out of the country. So I guess he can't really mess up too much if he's not here. He's down in Argentina where they're massing by the thousands to protest against him. While Bush is away, the Congress will play. The Senate has passed some budget cuts and will also now allow for oil drilling in Alaska that may end up creating a crater the size of the state of Connecticut, apparently, because they've finally decided to allow this to take place. And the House, at the same time, tables a bill on torture because they think, the Republicans, that is, think it might be too big a slap in the face of Dick Cheney, because Cheney has opposed this bill. The president has threatened to veto the bill. Now, we're all supposed, America's supposed to be better than the rest of the world. At least that's what we tell ourselves all the time, those of us who, wave the flag and that sort of thing. How in the world can we allow torture by statute in the law and call ourselves better than anybody else? How do we do that? How do we explain Dick Cheney to the rest of the world? How do we say to people, well, you can't torture anybody. You shouldn't be kidnapping anybody. You shouldn't rendition anybody. But it's okay if we do all these things. What are we different? Are we that special? Do we think we're that special. The House of Representatives apparently thinks we're that special. I know Dick Cheney thinks we're that special. But I got news for you, folks, especially those of you just waking up. We're not that special. If we want to be special, we need to lead through our own good example. And warfare and torture and unemployment and poverty and lack of health care is not the way to lead by our good example. Now, speaking of bad examples, let's switch focus for a moment to Tom DeLay, who's already facing money laundering charges, already facing conspiracy charges. You know, there's been an interesting back and forth about who is actually going to hear the Tom DeLay case down in Texas. But now, Tom DeLay, you know, it's interesting. A lot of these Republican guys, I don't know what it is about the Internet that these guys don't get. But when you send out emails, don't think you just send them out into the ether, and if you destroy them, that's the end of that. Because both Michael Brown and Tom DeLay, as we wake up this morning, folks, are being embarrassed by emails that they sent. Let's talk about Tom DeLay for a minute. He apparently asked Jack Abramoff, another indicted Washington, D.C. figure and former restaurateur, to raise money for him through a private charity controlled by Abramoff. These emails from 2002 refer to Tom and Tom's requests. Now, Tom who? Tom Carvel? No, sorry, he passed away some years ago. Uncle Tom? Nah, Michael Steele's busy in Maryland. Who do we got here? Tom DeLay. And here's another part of the email. Did you get the message that the guys that Tom wants to raise some bucks from Capital Athletic Foundation? These guys, it's amazing. They take money, and this is all, by the way, on behalf of Indian tribes who were looking to open casinos. And you know, that is America's great way of assuaging guilt over the genocide that we perpetrated on Native people in this country. Give a few casinos! Let them make a few bucks! Let a few of them make some bucks anyway. But be that as it may, I quibble, and that's a discussion for another day. The fact of the matter is that these guys had such a racket going on that they were taking money from these Indians and at the same time disparaging them in emails, in phone calls, calling them all kinds of names. And in a couple of cases that were documented earlier this year, they took money from one group to stop another group and then took money from the other group to stop the first group. What a racket. And they say organized crime is, you know, stuff in Five Points in the streets and the Godfather movies. This is organized crime, ladies and gentlemen. But be that as it may, he hasn't been convicted of anything yet. So he's innocent until proven guilty in our American system of jurisprudence. But this certainly doesn't look good for the guy, does it? This is typical of the kind of overreaching that, and I'm not even going to put it in a partisan context. It is the kind of overreaching that politicians do. And they do it because they don't think the American people are paying any attention. And it's Democrats and Republicans. Let's be real about this, okay? There's the former governor of Alabama, Spiegelman, Democrat. He got indicted recently. So it is not the sole province of the Republican Party. I, you know, being a Democrat myself, happen to think they do it a lot more often. I mean, it's good for my soul anyway. But what has to happen is that these parties commit to changing the way they do their business. Tom DeLay shouldn't feel empowered to take money from Indian tribes, or to call Jack Abramoff on the phone or have somebody emailing somebody talking about Tom wants this and Tom wants that. Tom should be serving his constituents from Texas, not lining his pockets and the pockets of his friends with money from people that are seeking to do business with the United States government. In this instance, by the way, there's another situation where tribal money went to a group founded by Interior Secretary Gail Norton. Why is Indian money being channeled through a lobbyist to a charity run by a Bush cabinet official? Because that's what we got here. We have money being filtered through a lobbyist. A guy, any of you been to D.C., you know where K Street is. That's where all these guys hang out, all right? They go to really expensive restaurants. They have all of these tax-deductible lunches, and then they provide access. All they really are, should I call them fixers, Brendan? Is that too strong a term? Yeah, they're fixers. That's what they do. They provide access to the corridors of power to people who would otherwise be shut out. And I, you know, it's a damn shame that these Native American interests have poured money into these people's pockets. On behalf of what? So, look, if people want to gamble, fine. I'm not a gambler. I have never gambled. Well, that's not completely true. I did go play a slot machine in Vegas once when a friend of mine went to the bathroom and I won $40. That's as good as it gets for me and gambling, all right? And I used to play Bidwist back in the day when I worked in Macy's in Manhattan. Bidwist is a black card game. Brendan's saying, what the hell is Bidwist? Bidwist is the black version of bridge, okay? That's about the closest I can explain. God, I'm realizing, I just said Bidwist because I figured everybody knew what that was. But no, it is an African-American version of bridge. I know there are going to be some African-Americans who call me up. What are you talking about? That's not what it really is. But Bidwist is a really fun game to play. Let's put it that way. Now, what we are talking about in terms of Tom DeLay and the future of this kind of politics in this country, because this is precisely what these guys are in office to do for people. Okay, they are in office for them to amass and manipulate power. That's what they do. And, of course, to make money, because none of these people are doing this for broke. And when you have a United States Senate that talks about cutting $35 billion from entitlement programs, social programs in this country, and then you see that people in the opposite house, who, by the way, table a motion on torture because they don't want to embarrass the stinking vice president. But in the meantime, it's never too early or too late to set up another deal, to make a little bit more money, to pass some money on in exchange for a little bit of influence. This must not stand. It must not be the way things go in American politics. Or one of these days, you know, we're going to hold an election and nobody's going to vote. Now, I don't think that's going to happen next Tuesday over across the river in New Jersey. Because, of course, in New Jersey, there's a gubernatorial race. There are two major gubernatorial races in the country this year. One is in New Jersey, one is in Virginia, and then there's the apparently lopsided New York City mayoral race. Well, over in Jersey, things have been down and dirty essentially since both of these guys got the nominations of their parties. But lately, it has gotten particularly, but I don't even know if it's peculiarly ugly. John Corzine, who's the United States Senator from New Jersey, is running for governor, in part because in New Jersey, the governor is invested with more power than probably any other state in the country. The governor gets to pass on virtually every appointment that's made in Jersey. That means the governor has an extraordinary amount of power, extraordinary power. Well, John Corzine happens to have an ex-wife, and if we had the song Cheaper to Keep Her, I certainly would play it at this point. John Corzine's ex-wife apparently gave an interview and dogged him out, okay? And I mean really dogged him out. Said he checked his principles at the door when he got into politics, that he checked his family at the door when he got into politics. And he said some stuff, some pretty unflattering stuff about a woman that Corzine apparently dealt with, a union official, who he later was accused of having arranged a sweetheart mortgage for. And according to the former Mrs. Corzine, this woman was the reason why their marriage broke up. At least that's what she broadly hinted. Well, guess what Doug Forrester, John Corzine's opponent, did? He took a little snatch of that. He did not take, you know, he didn't have her actually saying it in a commercial. But he did have a quote from it, from this interview, in a commercial. And the Corzine people are crying foul. They are screaming like crazy. Now, usually there are two things that happen when this kind of a cataclysmic commercial is aired in a particular place. Either if people are really sick and tired of attack ads, it bounces back and ends up hurting the person that ran the ad, in this case the Republican Doug Forrester. Or, and I'm sure this is what Forrester's hoping for, this reinforces for people, and remember that in New Jersey there are more independents than there are Democrats or Republicans. That's who everybody's trying to get on their side. What Forrester is hoping is that this will continue to play into the cycle of corruption and play for pay and some of the other issues that he has been hammering home in New Jersey and has hammered a double-digit lead down to about 7 to 9 points, depending on which poll you read. Now, the question is going to become, do Americans, or for that matter, do residents of the state of New Jersey, respond favorably, that is, go to the polls and vote for Doug Forrester as a result of these attack ads? I know what the polls say. The polls say, we hate these kind of ads. But in many instances, the things that we say we hate, like, for example, the religious rights hatred of pornography, In some cases, it's the religious right that consumes pornography. And this is the same thing with a negative attack ad. You may say you hate it, but you may go to the polls and vote because of it. And what I want to find out, man, give us a call, 866-303-2270. Do attack ads work for you? Do they work on you? Would they cause you to say, I'm not voting for someone that I otherwise would vote for because they printed or ran an attack ad on television, on radio, or in print? It's 46 minutes past the hour. Stay with us. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition. Call us at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270.
Call me, doggy.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron has a couple days off. He's still here. He'll be back with us on Tuesday. We're talking to you at 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270 about attack ads. And believe me, this one over in Jersey is a serious attack ad. It is called, quote, it's a 15-second spot. It has no spoken words, but it has a black screen that scrolls through a quotation that is attributed to candidate John Corzine's ex-wife, and it says, quote, he had let his family down, and he'll probably let New Jersey down, too. So that is a serious, and of course, the Democrats are calling this a last-minute act of desperation on the part of Republican candidate Doug Forrester. Now, what's interesting about this, when Forrester was asked about Joanne Corzine's remarks 2 days ago, on Wednesday, he said it was a private matter and said he would not use it in a campaign ad. But then yesterday morning, here comes the campaign ad. Is that flip-flopping? Do these kinds of attack ads have any effect? They've done polling in New Jersey in the run-up to this election. It says that New Jersey voters are sick and tired of the attack ads. Now, that doesn't mean that they will switch their votes because of attack ads. They just say they're tired of them. But, you know, you can be tired of an AutoZone ad, too. You still ain't going to end up watching it. What does this mean to you? Does it mean that attack ads do work? Is this fair game in a tight race for the governorship of a state? Let's go to our telephones. Let's speak first to Gene, who's calling us from Long Island. Gene, how you doing?
Hi, my name is Gene.
Yeah, I'm Gene. Calling. What's on your mind? Bring it.
My comment is that I don't believe in attack ads. I think that all it tells me about the person that's doing the attacking is that they don't have anything positive to say. But now, that being said, I think that it's obvious that it works on most Americans because, look, with the Republicans in particular, every time they've smeared someone, basically they've won. There's one thing that I think that you guys, I think you, at Air America, I think you're doing a great job, but I think you're too nice about one thing, and that's the fact that the average American is stupid, and the politicians, they know this. If they didn't think so, they wouldn't do these sort of things. I mean, how often do you see people walking around? Like, look at the last election with John Kerry. People were walking around calling him a flip-flopper and
saying, well, yeah, and in that instance, Gene, the attack ad worked.
In Vietnam, and they thought it was their own idea.
But let me tell you something, Gene. See,
Republicans told
hold up. Gene. Oh, Gene.
Yes?
Let me explain something to you. The problem with saying that the average person is stupid is that you don't get them to win over, you don't win them over to your side by assuming that going into a discussion with them. All right? You cannot convince voters to take a particular position by saying, hey, don't be stupid, do this. It doesn't work. It simply does not work and probably should not work. The founders of this country, by the way, kind of thought the American people were a little stupid, too. That's why they put many of the impediments to direct representative democracy in place way, way back in the day. Gene, thank you very much for the phone call. Let's go to Chris, who's speaking to us from the mic in Madison, Wisconsin. Chris, good morning.
Good morning.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. The particular ad that you're speaking of against Corzine, I do believe that is wrong, and that is a quote-unquote attack ad. But it seems as though the term attack ad has gotten a pretty broad definition.
And true.
If somebody is simply pointing out the facts about their opposition, in fact, that in, well, the example of the previous caller voiced, if John Kerry, in fact, did vote one way on one issue and then talk another way on that issue or vice versa, well, then that is a valid criticism. That is not an attack ad.
Well, do you think that Joanne Corzine's criticism of her ex-husband is a valid criticism?
Well, if it's her criticizing him, yes, but I do not.
That's all they put in the ad. Nobody says anything in the ad. There's no voice in the ad. All it does is scroll down a direct quote from a newspaper article where she said this stuff.
Yeah, well, that's not fair. That's not a fair game. And the reason they're doing it that way is so that they can take the position like you're saying. Well, hey, we're not doing anything. We're just showing you what was in print. But really, it crosses the line. That is an attack ad, and that's not right.
Okay, Chris, thanks a lot for the call. So there are some people who think it does cross the line. Let's go next to John, who's calling us from New York. John, good morning.
Morning.
How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Bring it. What you got?
I was going to say that I agree with the last caller. There's a difference between attack ads and a negative ad. But most of what we see are attack ads, and that ad certainly is just ridiculous. I remember Forrester's campaign a couple of years ago for the Senate,
mm-hmm.
just as desperate and just as nasty.
Really?
What I want to say is that I'm basically a lifelong Democrat. I have occasionally crossed the line when I thought the Democrat was just pathetic.
Uh-huh.
But generally, negative ads aren't going to affect me because I pretty much know who I'm going to vote for down the line unless something comes up. But
wait a minute, John. Let's sure. talk about that. If there's a negative ad, does that come into the category of something coming up?
I'm sorry, say that again?
In other words, if the person you think you're going to vote for comes out with an extremely negative ad, does that constitute something coming up that would make you vote differently?
That actually was about that. That's exactly what I was about to say. I'll stay home.
You stay home. You wouldn't vote for the other guy, but you wouldn't vote. You would just stay home and not vote at all.
Well, if I lived in Jersey and Corzine came out with an ad like the one that Forrester just came out, I'd stay home. I would never vote for Forrester.
Of this ad?
No, because he's just way, he likes to paint himself a moderate, but he's not. He's way too extreme in his views.
All right. Listen, thanks a lot for calling, John. Much appreciated. You know, it's going to be very interesting. Part of the reason why these ads are so numerous and can take, they're all spending their own money. All right. They're spending huge sums of money. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to be talking with Washington Wizards basketball player Etan Thomas about his new book of poems, More Than an Athlete. Stay with us. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio, 57 past the hour. Six minutes past the hour, and it's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is off today, a well-deserved day off. He is going to be back, and I'm repeating this again for all of you who are just waking up. I'm saying, where the hell's Maron? He will be back with us on Tuesday. So you got me for one more day. Deal with it. Good morning to all of you who have decided to make a difference in the world today. Good morning to people who grew up listening to the music of Al Green. Good morning to angry youth worldwide. Good morning to moms and dads going to parent-teacher conferences later on today. No matter how your kid's teacher tells you the kid is doing. Good morning to people who are looking for affordable health care. And that's because there may be a lot more of you out here if the House and Senate have their way. More on that in a minute. Special good morning to Dr. Robert Blair of Fort Lee, New Jersey, who later on this morning will be trolling through my mouth to do some dental work. Doc, please, don't hurt me, all right? Don't hurt me. I had this dream last night, man. It was a scary thing, Brendan. It was truly... Where's Chris Lopresto? Because I'm almost sure that this is something that's happened to him. Have you ever had a dream about something that was in... that you actually were going to do something that was real, but it was suddenly like you had been inserted like in a Three Stooges short or something?
Well, I don't know about the Three Stooges, but yes, the first part, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, I had a dream that, you know, I went into the dentist's office today, and, you know, I sit down in the chair, and the doctor's, oh, okay, sir. And he's got one of those big hammers in his head, you know, behind his back. Okay?
A sledgehammer?
No, one of those big wood hammers that they used to, like, knock you out with.
Oh,
okay?
Lord.
Yeah.
Like a mallet.
Yeah, a mallet. That was my anesthetic, by the way. Okay? And then on the other hand, he had one of those things that were that he was going to wrap around my tooth and tie to the door. All right, so I'm figuring like Curly's getting ready to do my teeth for me or something. And Dr. Blair is certainly not that. But I'm so paranoid about pain. I hate pain, man. It's a good thing I have never had any state secrets because I would have gave them up in a minute.
But I don't think it's going to drug you up, Riley. You're not going to feel anything today.
I feel stuff if they shoot 5 gallons of Novocaine in me, I still feel it. I can't help myself.
Oh, that's your brain playing tricks on you.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, when you get to be my age, your brain plays tricks on you every 5 seconds. What can I tell you?
You forget things.
Huh? Where are we? Is this, what show is this? No, I think I know where I am. I don't know if the Senate knows where we are, though. The Senate is getting ready to do some serious damage to working people in the United States, all right? They approved a 5-year plan to cut a variety of federal budget programs and to allow drilling for oil and natural gas in the wilderness area of Alaska, otherwise known as ANWR. And it looks as though, and by the way, this would pass by a vote of 52-47. 5 Republicans opposed this budget bill. 2 Democrats voted for this budget bill. And here's the problem, folks. This bill is supposed to cut $35 billion over the next 5 years. Now, they could have saved themselves a lot of trouble if they had cut those highway programs that they had, not highway programs, the boondoggle parts of the last highway bill, which totaled some $24 billion, and they'd only have to cut $9 billion. But here's the catch, ladies and gentlemen. They're still talking about tax cuts to the tune of $70 billion. Now, how in the hell are they going to, on the one hand, tell the American people, well, we're saving you money because we're cutting all of these different social programs, and there are a number of them, although, and we should say this in fairness, they didn't cut food stamps. Thank God they didn't cut the food stamp program, all right, because they were talking about cutting up to 300,000 some odd people across the country, the size of a medium-sized American city, off the food stamp rolls. That is not going to happen. But there are going to be other cuts. Now, here's the other catch. The House has a bill that would save $53.9 billion over 5 years, because the House always has to outdo the Senate. It's like keeping up with the Joneses or something. And that's about half, 50% more than the Senate bill would cut. This is the conservatives' collective wet dream, ladies and gentlemen. This is what they have been infiltrating government to do, to cut these programs because they've never liked them. They've never wanted them to become a permanent part of the American landscape. These are the same people, I'm quite sure. I wasn't alive then, but I'm quite sure some of these same types of people, some of these same people, let me best put this as ideological fellow travelers. These are the same people who would have said when, you know, Franklin Roosevelt was trying to pass, we don't need Social Security. What do we need that for? We don't need to do that. We don't have to give people money for when they retire. What's up with that? We see people, for example, finding that they don't have pensions, finding that they don't have a lot of the safety net that people thought would be there in times of trouble. That's just not there. And yet we have victims of hurricanes. We have people who are unemployed. But, you know, it's kind of like, well, hey, go ahead. You guys do the best you can do. And believe me, the House, in addition to what the Senate is up to, is doing its best to try and keep Dick Cheney happy by tabling a bill that would have outlawed torture on the part of the United States. You know, now, I don't know if it would outlaw renditioning or outlaw these kinds of secret CIA camps, which, by the way, now the European Union is looking into that story that we talked about yesterday, where apparently they have some CIA secret prisons across Eastern Europe and several other places in the world. And now the EU is looking into it because it may violate European law. But it doesn't matter to the House of Representatives, because the House of Representatives is more concerned with Dick Cheney, our vice president's ability to save face. Dick Cheney has been the point man, along with Alberto Gonzalez, that guy David Addington that he just elevated to one of the gigs that Libby used to have. All of these guys have been working since the beginning of the Bush administration to see to it that America's prerogatives with regard to interrogation, whatever they think is necessary to combat terrorism, they want to be able to do. Never mind the consequences for Americans overseas. Never mind the consequences for Americans in harm's way in places like, gee, can I think of one? Iraq, for example. Never mind that. We want to be able to torture people whenever the hell we want, and we want it into law. The Bush administration has promised to veto the measure that was introduced by Senator John McCain. I don't always agree with him, but on this, he took an honorable and principled position. Americans should not torture. Americans do not torture. Period. End of statement. All right? You want information out of people? Find another way to get it. You don't have to waterboard people and make them think they're drowning. You don't have to put electrodes on their nads or any of the rest of this foolishness that people around the world do. We are supposed to be Americans, and we're supposed to be better than this. And our House of Representatives is so concerned with Dick Cheney, saving face. This guy's going to have to get up and testify in Scooter Libby's trial, for God's sake. And we're worried about how he looks, about whether or not he's going to suffer a setback if Americans say we're not going to do torture anymore or tolerate torture anymore. How about we find out exactly where these CIA and places, there's been various published reports about where these places are. How about we find out where they are and shut them down? Incarcerate these people, certainly. If you want information from them, get it. But do not put them in places where they will live out the rest of their natural lives, where they will never have contact with anybody other than other CIA people. That's not the way we are supposed to do business. And fighting a war on terror is not an excuse for torture, okay? Now, some people may disagree with me, all right? If you disagree, call 866-303-2270. If you think torture is cool in pursuit of the war on terror, call. I'd like to hear from you. All right? And then I'd like to send you someplace where you're going to be in harm's way and wonder whether or not people are going to torture you. Because that's why you don't torture. So your people don't get tortured. Just like, you know, and see, this is a very simple thing. Anybody in New York understands this. You know, you have people that are attached to the United Nations here. They pretty much can park wherever the hell they want. You know why? Because they don't want, and you know, when they get tickets, local tickets, they're exonerated. They don't pay. And the reason why is because they don't want Americans to suddenly turn up who are billeted to, for example, an embassy somewhere, to suddenly turn up getting parking tickets that they are going to hassle with because, of course, there is some level of reciprocity. If you do something to a foreign national, then the person, the country where that person comes from may do that to one of our nationals. That's the reason not to do torture. That and, of course, the moral reason, that it's wrong. It's wrong, okay? You want to talk about morality? You want to talk about values? Let's take some time off from Dick Cheney and Karl Rove and Scooter Libby and everything. Let's talk about why Americans should not torture. And the larger issue, why Americans ought not go to war unless we are defending ourselves from a direct attack. Okay? Because for me, that's the only reason that justifies going to war, and I defy anybody to find that as far as this conflict in Iraq is concerned. Coming up, Eitan Thomas from the Washington Wizards is going to be joining us. He's going to talk about athlete activism, something we don't hear a great deal about. And certainly haven't heard a great deal about it lately, not since I was a much younger man than I am today. Later on today as well, California Congresswoman Maxine Waters joins us live on the telephone to talk about these latest House shenanigans and why they're trying to keep Dick Cheney out of harm's way. It's 17 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
21 minutes past the hour, it's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is off until Tuesday. And Lord have mercy. You see, Chris Lopresto put that dental commercial in there to scare me. I know he did. We had a dental commercial that was just on in the last commercial cluster, and it's because you're trying, you all are trying to spook me, okay? You're trying to get me to run out of here and not go to the dentist today, but I'm going anyway.
We'll have airline commercials next.
Oh, yeah, thanks loads. With, oh, never mind. Let me not get maudlin here. Coming up, Washington Wizards basketball player, former Syracuse star Etan Thomas is going to talk to us about his poetry and his activism. But right now, ladies and gentlemen, let's do a little thing I like to call the Morning Sedition Dog of the Week. Whoa! Wow, I thought it stopped itself. It's been another week with lots of doggish behavior, folks, from Scooter Libby in the docket to Mystery Man Rocco Martino, the Yellow Cake Document King. Oh, yeah, and there's Michael Brown, the former FEMA guy, whose emails during Hurricane Katrina make him look even more clueless than we thought before. But this week's dog is a right-wing operative who managed to rise to the exalted level of chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Ken Tomlinson used his title to start a right-wing coup against what he thought was a liberal bias in public broadcasting. How'd that work out for him? Like most conservative overreachers, not so hot. He had to step down as chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but his ultimate humiliation came this week as he was forced off the board of the corporation. It happened after an inspector general's report that had problems with Tomlinson's methods of bringing, quote, balance to the public airwaves. They included hiring a researcher to monitor Bill Moyers. Bill Moyers? Using a White House official to set up an ombudsman's office and secret payments to a pair of Republican lobbyists. Ken Tomlinson, in the end, was no better at his job than Michael Brown was at leading FEMA for confusing balance and objectivity with his own right-wing agenda. Ken Tomlinson, you are the Morning Sedition Dog of the Week. And you know what? He deserved it, too. I mean, that guy, you know, hey, say what you will about the CPB. You may like it, you may not like it, but let me tell you something. You don't go in there and try to do some kind of a right-wing push, you know, so Bill O'Reilly is on in place of Bill Moyers. That's nuts, okay? Let's go to our telephones. 866-303-2270 is our number. We were talking about the limits of torture, whether or not torture is necessary, a good thing, a bad thing. Let's go to Leon, who we're talking to from Miami. Leon, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, and yourself?
Good. What you got on your mind? Bring it.
Well, I got to tell you, I used to live in Israel, which is a country, as you know, that's been extremely devastated by torture, by terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And one step more is that if Israel were to not take on terrorism with such vehement action, terrorism would just continue in Israel nonstop. I'm not sure if you know this, but over 94% or 98% of all terrorist attacks in Israel are averted. And part of that is because of the extreme interrogation tactics that the Israeli officials use.
Now, what's the cause and effect there? Explain that to me.
What do you mean the cause and effect?
In other words, you're saying...
We instill a fear in the hearts of these terrorists so that they don't attack us. I'm not saying to attack...
But they have attacked you, haven't they? Haven't they attacked? They haven't stopped.
Averted over 98% of them.
Yeah, but you haven't...
I don't think you understand that.
No. Hold up. They still have... The 2% have got through, right?
The 2%
have gotten through because you have not stopped the source of the terrorism, have you?
Obviously.
I don't care how much torture you inflict on people. I don't care how much extreme interrogation. You have not stopped the impulse that has led to the terror. Yeah, you can stop 98%, but the 2% can kill you.
What are you saying? That all those hundreds of people that were saved because of those 98% that were averted was pointless, right?
No. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying to you is I don't think you can draw me a direct cause and effect between using extreme interrogation and the fact that 98% were stopped.
You can't?
No.
Okay, how about this? Just recently, there was a terrorist attack in Israel in the city of Hadera, where I used to live, actually, just 3 blocks away from my former apartment complex.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one step more, the next day after that attack happened, the person who sent the terrorists to the falafel stand to take out the attack assassinated by Israeli officials. You can't say that interrogation didn't help in that person's finding.
Okay, now wait. Hold up. See, this is one difference, Leon, and I thank you very much for the call. This is one difference between America and Israel. There is in America something called due process. So, you know, even if you think somebody did something, you know, the answer is not to have the government go out and kill them. Now, it may work in Israel, but A, it does not stop terrorism. It may stop 98%, but the 2% has been absolutely devastating, and it will never stop the impulse for terrorism. That takes a different kind of work, and that different kind of work does not, and I repeat, does not include torture. If you want to call it extreme interrogation because it sounds better to you, fine. It's still, in my book, torture, and it does not work. Anyway, before we go, I messed up. We were supposed to do a quick bit of Eitan Thomas's poetry, and we're going to do that. We're going to talk to him on the telephone when we come back. He is a basketball star for the Washington Wizards, and he's an activist. He is someone that is trying to make a difference in his community, make a difference among some of the athletes that he plays with, and we're going to find out his story next on Air America Radio. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Nation is keeping its greatest leaders in jail. What a time to return, resurrected in the sand. Tarnished the name of freedom.
34 minutes past the hour. We are listening to A State of War. Man, that's really nice, too. He needs to release that as a hip-hop song. My goodness. Our next guest is an NBA basketball player who's not afraid to speak his mind, be it on the death penalty, gun violence, or teen pregnancy. A few weeks ago, he spoke out against the war in Iraq at the Operation Ceasefire rally in Washington, D.C. Pleasure to welcome to our microphones, joining us by telephone this morning, Eitan Thomas. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How you doing?
Good, man. Thanks a lot for being with us. Much appreciated.
Thanks for having me.
You know, before we started this morning, I mentioned to the audience that I kind of considered you a throwback, and let me explain to you what I mean by that. When I was a kid growing up, there were a succession of black athletes, from Muhammad Ali to Bill Russell, who's quoted in the front of your book, to Jim Brown. I grew up during a time when all of these guys kind of came together as a group and spoke as a group on issues that were of importance to the African-American community and to the larger American community as well. And it seems to me that maybe a lot of your peers don't quite do that. You do. Why?
Growing up, those are the athletes that I really always admire. Those are athletes that I wanted to be like, you know, that use their position as a platform to really just speak out. I mean, because we have a voice. I mean, we have access to the media, we have a voice, and we have people that will listen to us just because we're athletes. And, you know, if you could say something positive, it's like there's just too much going on in the world right now for me personally to be quiet.
You know, it's interesting. Do you ever get your agent maybe say, hey, man, you know, if you don't talk quite so loud about these things, we might be able to get you on a sneaker commercial.
Well, you know, a lot of times, you know, especially when once I first started speaking out on different issues, it was kind of like a shock because, like you said, people don't really do it a lot. But, I mean, you know, the NBA, like the Wizards organization, the agents, they've been pretty supportive. They just said pretty much be careful and, you know, pretty much told me to proceed with caution. But, like I said, there's just too much going on right now.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when you say too much going on right now, people might jump to the immediate conclusion that you don't turn an eye either towards your fellow athletes or to very specific problems within the black community. Yet your book of poems, More Than an Athlete, would prove them wrong. Talk about how you focus on problems inside the black community that you think the black community ought to solve.
Well, there's a lot of different things. I mean, it's not like I'm afraid to talk about any certain issues. I mean, I go and I speak to schools a lot, so I'll speak to young brothers about things as far as, like, say I'll tell the story in a poem called Wasted Talent, and I'll tell the story of a guy that I grew up admiring how he played, and the only reason why he's not in the NBA today is because of the choices that he made, and the choices included, you know, drugs, guns, and crime, quick ways to make money. Mm-hmm. Or I'll talk to you know, young girls, and I have a poem called Babies Having Babies, and it's about, you know, these little girls getting pregnant and not valuing themselves and appreciating themselves. You know, I mean, I'm just not afraid to talk about certain things. Sometimes parents or older people try to kind of tiptoe around certain issues around with young people, and you just can't do that. You have to be direct with them.
Mm-hmm. The name of the book is More Than an Athlete. Poems by Etan Thomas, and he, of course, is a center for the Washington Wizards. Listen, you're going to go easy on our Knicks up here, ain't you?
No, of course not.
I just figured I'd throw that in. Listen, in the foreword to your book, you talk about why you write, and you say that it's a way to get frustrations out in a positive way. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, poetry can also be therapeutic. You know, I use it for a lot of different reasons, and you're going through something, and you just write about it. I mean, you know, I spoke to a youth prison. I do a lot of stuff with these youth prisons in D.C. And I always talk to them about, you know, different things that are going on, and you just write about it. And I just encourage them just to try it. And, you know, and we've been doing this program for, this is the second year, and, you know, they started writing different poems and different things that they were frustrated about, and they all just kind of took to it. I mean, because it's a good way to just get your frustrations out. You just write about it.
Mm-hmm. You know, you do talk to a lot of young people, and you mentioned in your foreword that you think that many of them are afraid to be themselves, that they have to kind of adapt or kind of have to conform to a particular way of being because that is, quote, the cool way of being. Right. What do you say to them about that?
Well, that's what I say. I just say just be yourself. And it's kind of hard sometimes because you have to know who you are as a person first before you can be yourself. I mean, and, you know, I tell the story in the foreword where I'm talking about how a young person came to me and was asking me why I don't have any jewelry on or why I'm not, you know, rocking the latest whatever. And I was like, well, that's not me. And he's like, well, what do you mean that's not you? And I'm like, well, that's not me. That's not what I wear. So he looked at me, and I had, like, these beads on because, you know, I wear beads for my West Indian culture or something like that. And he was like, well, what is this right here? I was like, these are beads. He's like, beads? Well, what are beads? I was like, well, you got to understand. And that's what I always tell young people is just be yourself. Be whoever you are. Don't worry about whatever anybody else thinks, you know. And it's kind of hard for young people to really grasp that because everyone wants to kind of fit in. You know what I mean? It just become one of everybody else. But I'm like, no, take the road less traveled.
You know, it's interesting. It seems as though the whole framework of this recent controversy in the NBA about the dress code started to center around the issue of people being who they are. You know, Allen Iverson is a jersey-wearing, do-rag-wearing guy. Other guys wear, you know, Shaq wears suits. What was your position on this NBA dress code? You got to wear business casual.
My position on it was, at first, you know, when I heard it, I was like, well, you know, I don't mind. You know, I guess we could dress up a little bit. But then once I started hearing the reasons for it, I was like, wait a minute. You know what I mean? wait, they want us to dress up because the perception of us is tainted, I guess? I was like, no, wait a minute. If I wear some business casual or I wear some sweats or I wear whatever, if somebody has already a predetermined feeling or notion about who I am as a person, it's not going to change because I have on some nice jeans and a shirt with a collar. You know what I mean? I think that's kind of playing to a societal ignorance, in my opinion. I mean, what matters is what's on the inside of the person. And if you don't really even want to see what's on the inside, and you're just concerned with the type of play that they have on the court, then it none of that even matters. It just kind of seems kind of ridiculous to me. But
yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it also depends on what people think. I mean, apparently Tony Kukoc showed up in a T-shirt. So, you know, I don't know if they think he's as big a thug as perhaps Allen Iverson. I don't know. But maybe there is a racial dynamic to this, which a couple of ball players have also mentioned. Is that something that concerns you?
Well, definitely. I mean, it's just a matter of how people perceive you in society. You know what I mean? I mean, it's just that's just kind of. When I go out and I'm driving around, say someplace in Virginia, and I get stopped like I have plenty of times just for pretty much, you know, driving a nice car in Virginia. I mean, it doesn't matter what I have on. You know, they're looking into the window and they see, wait a minute, he's not supposed to be here. I mean, and that's kind of the way it is, if somebody sees you already has a thought about who you are as a person, it's not going to change because of what you put on. I just don't think it is.
Our guest is Etan Thomas. He is center with the Washington Wizards. They're in town playing the Knicks. The name of his book of poetry, More Than an Athlete. Etan, we're going to play one of your poems, Republicans, mainly because they're some of our least favorite people.
Okay.
All right. Here it is. Etan Thomas's Republicans.
Republicans. Them hypocrites don't care about you. They just out to rescue their mission. They'll sing renditions of being for the people, but they sequels is everlasting. The rich get richer, and the poor don't get a damn thing. So how they keep getting reelected? They done took my people's dreams and wrecked it. Got me wondering where funding is coming from for my future children. Unless I shell out dollars and dollars for some overpriced private school, their education won't be valued. White kids in the suburbs get new books and computers. They'll get tutors and mentors to help them with algebraic equations while they cut the budgets of inner city schools, negating attempts to rescue young black minds, which are a terrible thing to waste. Cats in the hood be sharing used books, expected to overlook the 40 nappy heads packed in the classrooms like slaves, while underpaid, underappreciated teachers attempt to communicate to the masses of minds. It's a crime. Them masters of criminology, where air conditioner is considered a luxury, must be bad luck to be born on the wrong side of the tracks. Lost within the cracks of society, strategically placed at the end of the labor line, and Bush said no child shall be left behind. If dollar signs don't grace your wallet, education can't grace your mind.
All right. Etan Thomas's Republicans, and you subtitle that one Affirmative Action. You know, you've been doing some work in connection with both Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita that devastated the Gulf Coast region of the country. And I know that you, as I think many other people in the country, were kind of shocked by what Barbara Bush had to say about the folks that were, given refuge inside the Astrodome. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I just kind of wrote that off as the ignorance. You know, it was kind of hard to really believe that people really thought that. But I mean, I was more concerned with Bush's lack of response to the entire situation. I mean, everybody was trying to pat him on the back at first because he cut his vacation short 2 days, and I was like, are you serious? You know what I mean? That y'all patting him on the back for this? And then I just saw how, you know, the people were there for 5 or 6 days without food or water, and then the way that they you know, just ignored them. And then afterwards, you know, they had the police and the different, you know, security come down and try to enforce a curfew. And I mean, just the way the whole situation was handled, and it was just disgusting. It was disgusting that Americans were handled that way.
Absolutely true.
The people were making all the people from the right, you know, the Bill O'Reillys and the Sean Hannitys, are making all these excuses like, oh, he tried to do the best he can. Oh, Michael Brown was kind of, you know, shocked by the situation. I'm like, Michael Brown, first of all, shouldn't have been in that position in the first place.
Word.
You know what I mean? He was unqualified to be there. And it was just so interesting because the right, you know, they now after with Harriet Myers, then they wanted to shout cronyism. And Bush is now putting people in positions that he shouldn't have. And I'm like, but y'all didn't say anything about all the other people that he's done that with before.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's just, I don't know. The right, there's so many problems with the right now.
Oh, yeah.
See, I mean, you can kind of just keep going with that.
Definitely. Final quick question. Do you ever proselytize to your coworkers about becoming more active, more vocal in issues that affect the country?
I more talk to them about the issues, not more about them speaking out, because it's not for everybody. You know, everybody that's not their thing. You know, it's kind of always been, you know, a passion of mine. But you know, I can't really criticize them if that's not their thing. But I'll always talk about issues. Yeah,
yeah.
Sometimes, you know, they're like, okay, all right. You know what I mean? That's what
there he goes again. Yeah, I know. I understand. Etan Thomas, thank you so much for being with us. Hey, our door is open to you, man. Next time you come up, don't be a stranger, huh?
All right, thanks a lot.
All right, you take care.
All right, you too.
Washington Wizards center Etan Thomas, who wouldn't promise to go easy on the New York Knicks when they play later today here in the city of New York. Wow. He's a really deep young man, that's for sure. 47 minutes past the hour. Stay with us. We're going to be back with more stuff on Morning's Edition here at Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Cindy Sheehan. Whether I'm waking up in Crawford, Texas, Washington, D.C., or Vacaville, California, I wake up with Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Fifty-one minutes past the hour. It's Morning's Edition here on Air America Radio. My name's Mark Riley. Mark Maron is off until Tuesday. Hey, Brendan, can I go home now? Can I go home now? Can I go home now? That's Michael Brown in an email. Tom DeLay, Michael Brown, you should from now on, you know, in the mob, for a long time, people would only talk, you know, when they were afraid that people were going to bug their apartments or whatever, they would talk out in the street. And they would talk in code, and they would talk in ways that they would try to make as sure as possible that no one overheard them. And here comes Tom DeLay. Here comes Michael Brown. Now, for those of you who don't know who he is, Michael Brown is the former head of FEMA who gave us the response to Hurricane Katrina. And then he was the former head of FEMA, although he's still on the payroll when last I checked. Well, a bunch of his emails during and after Hurricane Katrina have been released. And let's say a special shout out and good morning to Representative Charlie Melancong, whose district includes part of the area south of New Orleans. He posted these things on his website. And folks, this gives new meaning to the term clueless. All right. Here's one of the things that was revealed in the email. All right. Apparently, 2 days after Katrina hit, one of the only FEMA employees in New Orleans wrote to Brown and said, quote, "The situation is past critical." Listed a bunch of problems that included people near death, food and water running out at the Superdome. You know what Brown's response was? Quote here, "Thanks for the update. Anything specific I need to do or tweak?" Gee, then there's a go-getter leadership kind of response, all right? Of course, he resigned on September 12th. But just in case you think that the Bush administration had any clue as to this guy's incompetence, let's go to what our president said about Michael Brown on September 1st of this year.
Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. The FEMA director's working 24/7.
Oh, yeah. $148,000 worth of heck of a job. Still on the payroll worth of heck of a job. And at one point, he wrote to Cindy Taylor, FEMA's Deputy Director of Public Affairs, "Can I quit now? Can I come home?" Gee, he should have done that before he was actually installed in the job, perhaps, don't you think? Maybe he should have gone home and quit back then. He also wrote to an acquaintance a few days later, quote, "I'm trapped now. Please rescue me." This is what Michael Brown was doing during and after a devastating hurricane, a hurricane that cost hundreds of American lives, okay? On August 26th, before Katrina made landfall, Brown emailed his press secretary about his attire, asking, tie or not tonight? Button-down blue shirt? Gee, I don't know, maybe turtleneck? I don't know. I don't know what this guy was thinking, or if he was in fact thinking, because at this point, I'm not really sure that Michael Brown was thinking at all. I don't know what Radio City Music Hall here in New York is thinking. I know a lot of you come into New York over the holiday season to see the big show, the Christmas Spectacular at Radio City. Well, it may end up being a little bit different than it has been in the past, folks. There won't be any musicians, live musicians in the orchestra. They've had a beef, Local 802 of the Musicians Union and the management of Radio City. And by the way, the management of Radio City is the same people that own the New York Knicks basketball club and the New York Rangers hockey team, neither of which have made the playoffs since Brendan McDonald was a wee child, okay?
That's not true.
I know it's not
the,
true.
The Knicks got me through quite a lot of hard times in the playoff season back in the early 90s. And,
yeah,
right,
you know,
until
what?
I stopped watching in 95.
Cablevision didn't own him in the early 90s.
Right.
they've managed to mess him up ever since. But be that as it may, they also own Radio City. They've had this beef. They had a one-day strike, and now apparently Cablevision and Radio City have locked the 35 musicians for the Christmas Spectacular out. Yesterday, they actually had the performance, but they used taped music. Now, you know, I have no problem with recorded music. I listen to it all the time on my new iPod Nano. But bottom line, I love to hear the music coming from live playing musicians. It's part of what really kind of makes me who I am. I love live music. I just do. And to say that you're going to lock out a bunch of musicians and that it won't make any difference to people, as long as the Rockettes are up there kicking, it doesn't matter whether you have canned music or live music. That might hold true in a discotheque. That might hold true in other kinds of applications, but not at Radio City Music Hall. Not during the Christmas Spectacular. Come on, Cablevision, do the right thing, won't you? I mean, all you got to do is, like, settle the beef over overtime, settle the beef over, you know, a salary, give these people a living, working wage, perhaps. Is that too much? You're paying Stephon Marbury stupid money. You can at least pay, you know, a violin player in the pit at Radio City Music Hall a couple of dollars. Let's hope this thing gets settled very, very soon. And, you know, there's some other bad news in terms of American consumers. Good news for Merck, the maker of Vioxx. A jury has found they're not liable for the death of a patient who took Vioxx. Scary, scary stuff. They did pull that, didn't they, Brendan? Oh, good. So nobody can take it anymore. Stay with us. Congresswoman Maxine Waters joins us next. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio, 57 minutes past the hour. Folks who came out to O'Neill's restaurant on 64th Street here in New York yesterday for a great final remote broadcast. There were people hanging on the chandeliers all over the place in there. Folks were actually sitting on the floor. Brendan, were there any seats left by the time we finished? I'm not sure there were.
No, Tim Robbins couldn't even get a seat.
Yeah, that's right. Tim Robbins had to stand up, for God's sake. And, you know, somebody reserved a seat for him. I don't know who took it. But it was really great to see everyone there. We really enjoyed ourselves much. And that was because of you who came to see us. Special good morning to firemen, to cops, to sanitation workers. See, most people are going to say, what? You don't like cops. But I say good morning to them anyway. Want to say good morning to the podcasters, to the streamers, to people listening in the UK, in Denmark, in Ghana, in Singapore, and everywhere else we can be heard. Good morning to evangelicals who can't quite figure out why things aren't working out the way they thought. And good morning to all of you, whether you're a doctor or somebody changing bedpans in hospitals across America and across the world, that is. A special good morning to Leslie from Scotland. She sent an email. We were talking earlier, you know, we were talking about gambling, and I made mention of Bidwist, thinking everybody would know what I was talking about. And I got like five quizzical looks across the glass, like, what? What is that? Well, I explained it earlier. It's an African-American game. It's kind of like the black version of bridge. But Leslie sent an email. I'm a black American gal in Scotland, and I have a big smile on face because you mentioned Bidwist. Actually, she just said bid. It reminded me of when my aunts and mother get together and play. We weren't allowed in the room, and my mom still hasn't taught me how to play. Amazing. And see, Bidwist is one of those games. I learned how to play Bidwist in Macy's, believe it or not. I was supposed to be working, but most of the time I was sitting up in the cafeteria playing cards with people. But Bidwist, and Bidwist is not one of those games you play for money, but it's one of those games that you just have a whole lot of enjoyment playing. And if you play it a certain way, you can do it real fast, so you can actually get like two or three games in on your lunch hour. If you haven't tried it, check it out. Wayne Gilman, the infamous news daddy, said that Bidwist is passe and nobody plays it anymore. But that's just him, you know, because he's old and he's, you know, trying to move on, whatever. I started to say G. Gordon Libby, but of course it was G. Gordon Liddy, and Lewis Libby is Dick Cheney's chief of staff. At least he was until Cheney probably told him, hey, it'd be nice if you resigned. You've been indicted. Well, he had his arraignment yesterday in court. Brought two really high-priced mouthpieces with him, two guys who are really good at getting white-collar criminals off. Scooter Libby says, hey, I am not guilty. of the charges against me, a 5-count felony indictment that could put him away for 30, count him, 30 years. And a lot of people don't mention this. Also, a $1.25 million fine. Now, that may just be chump change to a, you know, go-getter like Scooter. I'm sure he's got that stashed away in an account somewhere. Maybe Paul Bremer brought it back from Iraq for him or something. I don't know. But if he's convicted, he would have to cough up that kind of money. And the question now is fast becoming, what happens when Scooter goes to trial and they start calling people like Ari Fleischer, and people like, I don't know if they'll call Ken Mellman. They might call Karl Rove. They might call the Vice President of the United States. They might call Andrew Card. They might call all of these different people to testify in open court about what they said and what they did in the run-up to the war in Iraq. And you know what? That will be embarrassing. And I do mean embarrassing for the Bush administration beyond what we've seen so far, which I kind of really thought was pretty embarrassing already. Right now, it's a pleasure to welcome to our microphones the Congresswoman representing the 35th District of California, the Honorable Maxine Waters. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
You sound great.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Now, you've played BidWiz, haven't you?
No, I don't play any cards.
You don't even play BidWiz?
No.
Oh, my God.
No, my husband is the card player. He's the guy that is good at all that stuff.
Oh, he's good at okay. Now, speaking of card playing, looks like the House of Representatives is playing cards when it comes to Dick Cheney's reputation and that bill on torture. What happened there? They tabled it? What was up?
Well, I don't know what happened. The fact of the matter is there are a lot of investigations that got to go on. It seems that, you know, a lot is being unveiled. The fact that there are prisons in other countries where they're holding so-called suspected terrorists and the possibility of torture that's going on with them. So much is unveiling on this administration. As a matter of fact, the dislike for our country is reflected in this visit to Argentina, where Bush is there with his wife and people are coming out in droves to burn our flag and to say, we don't like you, go home. I mean, it's blowing up. This administration is unraveling.
Yeah, it certainly is. By the way, did you think that President Bush slighted the civil rights movement by not going to Rosa Parks' memorial service yesterday?
Well, let me just say this. I don't expect much of Bush and this administration. The world literally turned out for Rosa Parks. I mean, people who weren't even in this country were glued to their televisions or holding memorial services. And, of course, it would have been good for the President of the United States to attend. But, you know, we're dealing with a different set of animals here.
Yeah, scheduling problems, I guess, huh? Congresswoman, I know that you have been one of the people who has been speaking out quite vocally about the issue of eminent domain. And this is an issue that's near and dear to my heart because when I was growing up, my parents had some land condemned because of eminent domain. In fact, they were building an interstate highway near our house, and we ended up being landlocked because they took our land.
Wow.
Now, what exactly is going on? It was discussed on the House floor yesterday.
Yeah, we had a big vote on the House floor yesterday, and I have been upfront and outfront on this issue. The Supreme Court issued a decision not too long ago that basically said cities and community redevelopment agencies, any of these entities that have eminent domain power, can literally take private people's property and give it to another private individual for development. This happened in the Kello case, where the Pfizer went up and built one of these huge office buildings, and they spied this little area right next to the big office building that they had built and decided that they wanted that too. So they went to the city, they gave them their eminent domain power, and they are trying to exercise that to take these people's homes to build condominiums. So I'm like you, I've seen, you know, the taking of private land by cities and redevelopment agencies, basically for developers, for people who want to build shopping centers and parking lots and what have you. I'm adamantly opposed to it. So it was a strange combination on the floor yesterday. I joined with very right-wing conservatives who are property rights guys to team up against so that we could pass a bill that would stop these cities. We would penalize them if they try and use eminent domain that way.
Any chance of it passing?
Oh, it passed big time.
Oh, it did pass already.
It passed off the floor. I don't know exactly what the vote was, but something like 300 and something to 38 or something. It was big.
Will Bush sign it if it comes across his desk?
I believe so. If it gets to his desk, he will sign it. We've got to see what they're going to do on the Senate side. But this is a real people's issue. I mean, the average person sitting out there who's purchased their home or their business, they don't want the government coming in and taking their property away from them for any reason. But these developers have a lot of money, and they are giving a lot of money to local politicians in their campaigns. The relationship between the developers and city council members and mayors is such that they can walk through there and kind of get what they want. So this bill will stop them. And, yeah, I think if it gets to the president's desk, because you have so many conservatives who are opposed to eminent domain, the taking of private property for private development.
All right. Our guest is Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Congresswoman, the Senate passed a bill yesterday that would be trim about $35 billion over the next 5 years from what they call, I guess, social spending programs, federal benefit programs.
Yeah, this is a shame. I mean, this is an embarrassment. This reconciliation bill that is being passed through this Congress, where they are slashing these social services programs because of the deficit and because we're spending $1 billion a month in Afghanistan and $1 billion a week in Iraq, it's just awful. They're trying to get us to cut food stamps and hot lunch programs and on and on and on. The American people should be outraged that their tax dollars are being pissed away over in Iraq and Afghanistan and given to Halliburton to lie to us about what services they're providing us when they're not, and then we're cutting our domestic programs in the way that we're doing. This administration is ruining this country.
Congresswoman,
we really do have to change.
Look in your crystal ball. Apparently, the Republicans in the House have drafted a bill that would save $53.9 billion, $54 billion over 5 years. When it comes out of the House, what do you think that number will be?
I don't know, but the Republicans are walking lockstep together. They're in control. They have the numbers. We can't find, over on the other side, decent moderates who are willing to stand up to the president and delay and the leaders over there. So I don't know what that number will be, but I can tell you they are about to hurt the American public in a very big way in the way that they are slashing these domestic programs.
Congresswoman Maxine Waters, as always, great to talk with you. Thanks so much. Talk to you again soon, huh?
Thank you. Nice. Have a good day.
All right. Have a good day and a good weekend.
All right. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Congresswoman Maxine Waters from California. We're going to be back, and we're not finished. We're not finished, so don't go anywhere. We've got a guest who's publishing a new magazine called The Ecologist. It's a big hit in the U.K. It's getting ready to debut here. He'll be joining us later on. We're going to talk about some more stories that are in the news. When we come back here on Air America Radio's Mornings Edition, it's 17 past the hour.
Mornings Edition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
Twenty-one minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is off. He will be back on Tuesday. And with us in studio is a man that I'm sure many of you longtime Morning Sedition listeners are quite familiar with.
Oh, please.
He is the man they call News Daddy in his spare time. But normally he is Wayne Gilman.
Well, thank you very much there, Mr. Riley. I've always spoken highly of you, too. And as I say always,
yes,
when I walk in here, every once in a while, I'm granted dispensation to do this.
A special dispensation.
Right, special.
From our, well, never mind.
Senior management.
Senior management.
Right.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we talked earlier this morning about this Doug Forrester ad that used some disparaging comments that John Corzine's ex-wife had to say about him in an article in the New York Times.
Uh-huh.
Now, You and I have been around for a long time, okay?
Right.
We have
this
seen a lot of negative ads in politics, okay? Where does this one rank on the scale?
Well, I don't know. I tell you, I mean, the thing is, I had a chance to see it just before leaving the house this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And if you
they're showing them that early?
Yeah, they are. I mean, no, seriously. I mean, well, listen, we're only days away before the election on Tuesday, and his poll numbers are down.
So oh, what, Forrester's number.
Yeah. You know, so, I mean, the thing is, I expect this sort of thing. I see a lot of ads in which Giuliani is featured with Forrester.
Yeah, I cleaned up
you know,
New York.
I tell you, you know, I mean, I don't know what New York he's speaking of, but that's another story. But, you know, as far as using an ex-wife to comment, and I know you know, I won't even speak of my track record, but you know, all those of us those of us who are familiar with exes, you know, we we don't ascribe to anything. No, I shouldn't say that, but I really thought that was low.
It was fair game?
Why would it be fair game?
Because she said it.
What does her involvement have anything to do with this contest?
Well,
I admit she was a loyal companion for many years. And it may sound like sour grapes to some people, all right?
Yeah.
He moved on.
Yeah.
To some people.
Yeah.
You know?
But, you know, see, here's the thing. When you start talking about people's private lives on a certain level, when the person that talks about them connects their private life to what the kind of job that they'll do in public life, which is what she did.
Yeah.
She said, look, he wasn't great for my family, and he won't be great for New Jersey. Or he let New Jersey down.
The thing is, she unfortunately gave an interview to the New York Times about it.
Mm.
I don't see Forrester necessarily, and this is not saying this is to his credit, he didn't go out of his way to get any film clips of her saying that, which probably would have been even far more effective.
Well, on Wednesday, he said he wasn't going
to
do it.
You know what bothers me about Doug Forrester? Why did he wait until now to run these ads and not before the debates and things
well,
like that?
Well, because Because
he knew this would come up as an issue.
The interview didn't happen until Wednesday.
No,
the interview wasn't printed until Wednesday.
Things don't happen in a vacuum, Mark.
What?
Please, you don't think that they didn't look into this long before, and you don't think there hadn't been any contact with his ex-wife about this?
Who, Forrester?
Yeah, and I'm not in the state of New Jersey.
Now you're making a pretty wild allegation.
I'm not in the state of New Jersey. I'm a registered Democrat here in New York. But please.
I care about your personal life.
Hey.
No, I mean, look, I don't understand at a point. It's politics.
Yeah.
All right. We've seen the gross ugliness of politics up close and personal in our 30-some-odd years each of doing this job. Right? It's ugly. Part of the reason why I think this is happening, okay, is because here in New York, and folks, you all across the country, get ready for this because it's going to happen to you soon, too. We've got three candidates running for office in New York and New Jersey, all of whom are multimillionaires or billionaires. When you can spend whatever you want to win an elected office, I believe that's when the attack ads come forward most forcefully.
Well, so it happened in other parts of the country, if you want to look at
other parts of the company.
Country.
Yes,
you know,
you.
I'm still waking
Clean
up.
Clean that up, pal.
I need to get caffeinated real bad. But the thing is that you look at the Schwarzenegger contest, you know? I mean, he spent tons of money, and he had all of his Republican cronies.
But he didn't
out
talk about his opponent's ex-wife, did he?
No, he don't. But I mean, but the fact you just mentioned the issue of money, and I really think it's despicable. I mean, the deal is, I happen to like, you know, some of the things that Bloomberg has done over the last 4 years.
Are you one of them black Democrats?
No. I didn't say that. I said I happen to like.
I'm
also saying that I think Freddie Ferrer has been dealt a disservice because the as far as the playing field being level, it's not.
No,
you know,
well,
he
no,
doesn't
it's
have
not.
The money. No. You
but
know.
That doesn't mean that Bloomberg shouldn't be able to spend what he wants, does it? If he opts out of the
I
system.
Think there should be some limit to that.
How are you going to do that? That's First Amendment.
I know. But,
they hide
but
behind the same amendment that allows
something has got to happen. You know? So any rich boy comes along, you know, they can buy an office.
Well, that means there's hope for you, man.
Well, I hope so one day, you know. Just waiting.
You got plenty of dough.
I'm just waiting.
Liquidate your investments. Next thing you know, it'll be Mayor Gilman.
You know, you have a tendency to personalize a lot of things with me whenever I come here.
Who?
That's why I have a reluctance to coming in. I don't get this with Rachel. I don't even get this with Maren, you know.
You're my main man.
Yeah,
you know,
I guess so.
My brother.
Yeah. My brother business, yes. It's always back to that.
Thanks
my
for
brother.
Being here.
Brendan,
thanks for
my brother.
Zach Goldsmith is up next. He's editor of a new magazine called The Ecologist, and he'll be joining us live in studio here on Morning Edition, Air America Radio, 27 past the hour.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Air America Radio.
34 minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is off. He will be back on Tuesday. And we've got some late news from the Labor Department. Actually, it's early news from the Labor Department. They report the economy added all of 56,000 jobs in October, and the unemployment rate dipped to 5%. Now, the unemployment rate dipping to 5% may be all well and good, but 56,000 jobs. Has anyone who has heard former Labor Secretary Robert Reich on the air with us talking about 56,000 jobs? That's nothing. That's a drop in the bucket. So let's be real about it. And then maybe they'll even adjust them down another month or two from now, because it seems like they do that quite a bit. Our next guest is editor of the UK-based Ecologist magazine and a first-class troublemaker, if what he says off the air is true. He spent the last week in New York hanging out with people like Kofi Annan, Sting, Prince Charles, and Camilla, talking and strategizing about the best way to get the message out on environmental responsibility. Let us welcome Zach Goldsmith in our studio this morning. Zach, good to see you. Thanks
good
for being
you.
Here.
Thank you very much.
Now, tell us about the Ecologist. You told me that they banned your magazine from newsstands in England. I thought England was supposed to be the land of the free, like here.
We have it. We were banned twice. So the last time we were banned, it used to be a magazine that was sold in the shops. We had to become a subscription magazine, although we built bridges and mended things since then. And it was really because we were taken on by your Monsanto Corporation, U.S.-based.
Ours?
Not very popular here.
Thanks for sharing.
But I'm sure your listeners know about Monsanto. But it's a very litigious company. We did a whole issue on them and their track record and their plans to really usurp much of the food chain. And the effect was that they went for all the people associated with the magazine, the printers, the distributors, the retailers, and so on. They never came for us, unfortunately, which is what we wanted. We were expecting and looking forward to a court battle in England, which would have put these issues, in my view, it would have put Monsanto on trial, even though technically we would have been on trial. But it unfortunately never happened.
Well, so they were trying to be crafty then.
They were trying to be crafty. They wanted to stop. They wanted to create it. That would create a situation where we wouldn't be able to get the magazine out. But we had a lot of supporters, and we were able to. We had to. We did deals with printers. We finally got the thing printed. It was a very ugly paper, very ugly issue, because we had a sort of 12-hour period to do it. But instead of selling, at the time, we were selling tiny numbers, 3,000-4,000 copies at a go. We sold about 600,000 copies.
Whoa!
So as a result of this sort of clumsy involvement of Monsanto. So we're grateful to Monsanto.
Yeah, I guess you'd be saying thanks.
They handled our PR a lot better than... Not better than I could have handled it.
So you know, it's interesting. We just saw a situation here in the States where the Senate passed a bill that allows oil drilling in the Alaska Alaska Natural Wildlife Reserve.
Yeah.
And, you know, issues like that don't always get a great deal of traction in the States. Mm-hmm. People say, oh, what's Alaska, man? I'm not going to. And plus, you know, we need the oil, we need the jobs, that sort of thing. Do you think that when people say, look, we need the oil because, you know, we have to keep the country running, that's an argument that resonates with a lot of Americans. Does it resonate overseas? Should it resonate?
Well, I think it's, look, as far as I can see, and I think it's sort of maths, not opinion. I mean, it's a matter of fact that we are going to have an oil crisis at some point. Oil demand is going through the roof. China's demand is doubling every few years. India's thirst for oil is growing very quickly. So is yours here. So is ours in the UK. So oil demand is increasing. Supply is not increasing. It's a mathematical fact that at some point there's going to be an oil crisis. We already know the sort of political and financial cost of maintaining our access to oil. So any policy that doesn't involve reducing our dependence on oil, for me, is a mad policy, because there's going to be a massive upheaval when resources begin to dwindle. So irrespective of climate change, which is my concern, but regardless of climate change, even if that's a pure myth, we still ought to be moving towards a situation of reducing our dependence on oil. And actually, if you look at if all of the Alaskan oil was successfully exploited, you're talking about 3 or 4 months worth of American consumption. So it's really you're really cashing in millions of years of evolution for a tiny amount of oil needs. And the equivalent could be saved with a fraction of a percent of an increase in fuel efficiency in cars, for example, which for me is a no-brainer. That really is where the campaign ought to be.
But you know, there are magazines here in the States that say the whole fuel economy thing is a game too. That in fact most Americans cars sold in America get about 30% less per gallon, the mileage per gallon, than the EPA estimates actually say. Mm. So they're not really as fuel efficient, even as people are saying.
Yeah.
But where is the first step toward cutting the tide, toward cutting this dependency? Because you're talking about, I think, for a lot of people, a change in the way they live, and that scares people.
Yeah, but you see, there are certain things that can be done immediately which don't require sacrifice on the part of the individual. I mean, fuel efficiency in cars is one obvious thing. There was a bill introduced to Congress about a year and a half ago, I'm not sure if that's a technical term, which would have required automakers to increase the fuel efficiency of their cars by a few percent, which would have resulted in saving, in terms of oil, the same amount of oil that America currently imports from Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. It would have increased cost of production of those cars by 2 or 3%, which is what commodities do every day in any case. Copper yesterday moved about that amount. So it wouldn't have had a big impact in terms of the cost. It would have saved consumers a lot on their energy bills, their oil bills. And it would have been obviously fantastic news for the environment, and it would have been good politically because it would have reduced your dependence and by extension our dependence on the volatile Middle East. So, it's a win-win-win situation.
And I know, but it didn't happen.
It didn't happen. And I suspect I can't see any reason, any explanation other than the fact that there are too many vested interests contaminating politics. And it's the same story in Britain as you have here. So really it's about public pressure, trying to get a bit of political honesty at the top levels so these decisions are taken. There are other things that could be done as well. I mean, in England, and I'm sure it's the same here, we have, supermarkets are totally in control of the food economy to such an extent now that four retailers control about 80% of all food purchases. Now, you go to a Sainsbury's, for example, and you pick an English apple and you think you're doing a good thing, buying local food, supporting the local economy. That apple would have been flown to South Africa, waxed and cleaned and flown back and put on the shop shelf. And it's in my...
Wait a minute, doesn't that cost energy?
But that's the thing. There's no tax on aviation fuel at all. And if there was, that kind of madness just wouldn't happen. There will come a time when people look at that and they think, well, how the hell could they undervalue oil so dramatically? So another thing that really we should be campaigning for is a tax to be put on aviation fuel, to make it politically saleable, just in terms of freight, not people. I mean, you can still have your cheap flights and all the rest of it, but a tax on aviation fuel in relation to freight would force the economy to come home slightly. So, you have tuna fish caught here on the East Coast, flown to Japan, put in cans and process and flown back here.
Yeah.
And it's really a madness. And
but, when you talk about that, when you start talking about, cutting some of these really inefficient ways that the economy works, because, I mean, that's what you're really talking about. It seems like all of the vested interests in the food chain, for example, you talk about less flights, the airline industry suddenly says, wait a minute, we're broke. Our airlines are going bankrupt. You can't tax our fuel. We'll go out of business.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have a point?
Well, I don't know what the impact would be on. Obviously, there would be less freight. In the kind of future that I think is compatible with life, I think there would be less food being flown around the world unnecessarily. That would have an impact on the airlines. But it would have a very, very positive impact on our rural communities. I mean, in Britain, we lost 20% of all our farm workers in the last 2 years. 50,000 out of a total... In 2 years.
Wow.
Out of a total of 250,000. So those people have got to go somewhere. And their knowledge is no longer relevant in the city. I mean, these are people who've grown up as part of a farming culture. They're valuable. And they're being rendered pretty much destitute. They're earning an average of £8,000 a year to survive on the average farm in Britain. That's not enough. As a result, there's no new generation of farmers. Now, for me, that's a tragedy. It's a cultural tragedy, but it's also, there is something called food security. And in Britain now, we're totally dependent for our most basic survival on imports. And I think that's mad. I think we need to have some kind of domestic food infrastructure in place. I mean, the fact is, if you look around the world, the global food system is very, very vulnerable. You've got the world's bread baskets shrinking. The Punjab is 50% desert now. Mm-hmm. The northern plains of China, where they produce 2/3 of all their grain, is shrinking by 10,000 square kilometers a year. The UN said about 2 months ago that we're losing 250 million acres of land every year. So the global food, and combine that with the oil shortages, which we're certain to see, and the water shortages, which already affect 90 countries. And it's pretty obvious that the global food system isn't pretty secure. We're reliant on an unreliable system.
Well, here in the States, we have a situation where you've got, these harvesters that are as big as this building that run all through the Midwest. And, there's been a corporate takeover of agriculture here. So that the family farmer essentially doesn't exist anymore.
I know. Yeah, I mean, I haven't spent a lot of time in the States, but I've met up with a lot of people who are family farmers. There is still something there, but you're right. I mean, the scale of operations here is sort of defies belief.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if you think, even the World Bank is now admitting, finally, after years of funding the wrong kind of agriculture, they're admitting that a small, diverse, traditional farm is more productive per unit of land. It's not more productive per unit of labor, obviously. It requires more people to get it to produce. But in terms of the amount of food you get from a piece of land, the small, diverse, traditional farm is more productive. The Mexican government has done the same study. They weren't looking for the same results, but they got those results. Mm-hmm. And the USDA here, which is very pro-big business, pro-GM food and so on, has said the same thing.
All right. Our guest is Zach Goldsmith. He's editor of the magazine The Ecologist. It is going to be rolled out here in the United States very shortly. It's been making a lot of noise over in the UK. Now, let's get to the important stuff. Charles and Camilla, they're here in this country. They met with the president the other day. You had a chance to talk with him?
Yeah. I mean, for me, Prince Charles, the irony is that Prince Charles is attacked mercilessly by the British press.
For everything.
And really, a lot of it's just nonsense, but he's in a position where he can't defend himself. I mean, if you were to accuse him of something horrific, he can't sue you, because the value to any media group of having him in the dock is much greater than anything that's going to be awarded against you in damages.
Really?
So he's like a sort of whale on the beach that people can peck at. And the British press have taken advantage of that. But the irony is that, in my view, he is pretty much the only responsible member of the British establishment. He's the only person who says things which resonate well ahead of his time. And I think one of the reasons for that is because of his royal position. He doesn't, you know, you can't promote him and he can't be bought off. He doesn't need to be bought off, which means he's got the luxury of being able to take a long-term view, which, as you know, career politicians don't do.
No, they don't. But, you know, do you think he gets more traction than, for example, Tony Blair? Do these negative developments, the decline of the family farm and that sort of thing, does it backwash on Blair at all?
What he does, and the reason why the establishment in Britain doesn't particularly appreciate him, is because what he is very, very good at is picking an issue before it becomes too political and raising awareness around that issue, forcing the establishment to answer questions which it would rather not answer. And that happened with GM. If we had a big debate and ultimately a backlash against GM food in Britain, I would say that's almost completely down to Prince Charles.
Really?
He raised that issue, he wrote articles for the press, he gave speeches, and he asked very pertinent questions, which people didn't want to have to answer. And the effect was that people saw these questions, they saw that the establishment was backing off from answering them, and this sort of public pressure built up. The moment it became political, obviously, he had to back off, because he's not allowed to be political. And the same has applied to so many different issues, largely in relation to technology, which, you know, a lot of these new technologies, the market is so far ahead of the science that really it's a gamble.
Yeah.
On a lot of different levels.
Now, you've gotten into politics a little bit. You've gone in as a Tory. You're a conservative?
I'm not a politician, but I've now in a position where I could stand for a seat in Britain if I wanted to.
Really?
Which I think I will. Excuse me.
What? See?
God, you see what happens
when
you
talk
about?
Office made you gay.
I know. God, I know. It's not something. It took me a long time to reach this decision, and I hope it's the right decision. But my view is that you can't. There are three parties in Britain that have any hope at all of doing anything in terms of achieving government, and two of them are just beyond reform. The Conservative Party is totally disorganized and weak and on its knees at the moment, and for me, a party that's that weak is a party that can be influenced. And I think that at a deeper level, environmentalism, looking out for future generations and so on, it really is a small c conservative cause.
I mean, yeah, but you can't turn those guys into Greens.
I don't know about that. I think there are a lot of people there who are thrashing around like sort of drowning men, looking for new identity, looking for ideas. And for me, I mean, conservatism is about decentralization, local democracy, precautionary principle with new technologies, a small business, small-scale agriculture, all these things. The trouble is that in the Conservative Party in England at the moment, and historically, at least for the last couple of generations, there haven't been any conservatives. I mean, they're radicals. You know, there's nothing more radical than gambling with the future of the only planet we know can sustain us.
Well, you know, our conservatives here are in bed with a lot of the big corporations that are, in fact, raping the planet. So it's
absolutely
a little difficult sometimes to get. And I mean, they tend to call environmentalists tree huggers or they tend to dismiss people that have any concern. You saw what Bush did with the Kyoto Accord.
Yeah.
He just basically tore them up and ignored them.
But you see, Bush is not a conservative. He's very right.
He's not?
He's a radical. Oh. It's not. Wait, by my understanding of the word, he's not a conservative. Conservative. He is not. I mean, conservative. You know, he is a radical. I mean, everything he's doing is radical.
Yeah.
He's jeopardizing the future of the planet. That, I mean, if you look up the word conservative in any dictionary, you won't see anything that relates to Mr. Bush's, President Bush's ideologies and campaigns and so on. It's just it's the wrong term.
Definitely. Zach Goldsmith, we're out of time, but when can people access The Ecologist on newsstands here in New York? How long will it be? Or in the country, I should.
At the moment, we're just doing a few testers. We've done a deal with Barnes & Noble. They're doing a big promotion in 50 of their stores. But really, I think the best thing is for people who are interested is to look at the website, and that'll give you all the information you need.
And what's that address?
www.theecologist.org.
The Ecologist.
Theecologist.org. If you do .com, you're going to find a nasty story. Someone bought .com to try and blackmail us into buying it. And it's
what, you got a porn site there or
something? It's very hardcore pornographic merchandise. But I sort of think it's quite fun, so I haven't bought it. I've left it. But that's not The Ecologist. If you tap into that by mistake, you've been warned.
All right. Zach Goldsmith, thanks a lot for being
with us.
Thank you very much. Best of luck with The Ecologist.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to wrap this thing up momentarily. It's 49 minutes past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Dar Williams. After a long night of electric guitar solos, pyrotechnics, trashed hotel rooms, and bad eating, I listen to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. And folks, the New Jersey gubernatorial race isn't over yet, but it's getting uglier by the minute. We told you earlier this morning that there's an ad run by Republican candidate for governor of New Jersey, Doug Forrester, that quotes John Corzine's ex-wife. And that quote is as follows, and it was it's a pretty big dig. Quote, when I saw the campaign ad where Andrea Forrester said Doug never let his family down and he won't let New Jersey down, all I could think was John did let his family down and he'll probably let New Jersey down too. All right, so that's step number one. Of course, the Corzine people didn't react well to that. Well, there's another side to this story, ladies and gentlemen. Now, apparently, there are email again. You're listening, Mike Brown. You're listening to Tom DeLay. There are email rumors that Doug Forrester allegedly had an affair with a former Miss New Jersey who's now a lobbyist. That's not him hitting her, by the way. That's John Corzine's campaign hitting back. The Forrester people are very upset about this little contretemps. Is that the proper term? I don't know. Anybody from France in our studios? At any rate, it looks as though, according to Sherry Sylvester, a spokesperson for Doug Forrester, she traces these emails and these rumors to one place, the dastardly campaign of John Corzine. Quote, these are the people who brought you Jim McGreevy and Bob Torricelli. They have absolutely no political chips. Now, you'll notice, folks, that this it's getting so bad in New Jersey. My home state, by the way. It's getting so bad that they're both accusing each other of exactly the same thing. The Corzine people said that Forrester was desperate for running the ad with his ex-wife, and now these rumors are attributed to the Corzine camp, although the Corzine camp says it didn't come from them. And, of course, the Forrester people say they have absolutely no political chips. Now, you know, you cannot ban negative advertising. I think there are some people who wish they could. I'm sure there are some people who would like to see it banned, but you're never going to ban it. But this, and by the way, there's no ad that Corzine has run about this little rumor thing. And by the way, just for you who might think, well, maybe he did it. Maybe, you know, did he issue a denial? Yeah, he did kind of sort of issue a denial. He said, or actually Sherry Sylvester, his mouthpiece, said, these emails and rumor are outrageous and untrue. This is absurd, end quote. Now, what they're talking about is a 2002 alleged relationship between Amy Osborne, the former Miss New Jersey, who worked on Doug Forrester's failed Senate bid in 2002. Now, it just goes to show you, this is the real nature of politics, ladies and gentlemen. This woman who's now was a former beauty queen is now a lobbyist. Now she is, you know, following in the grand tradition of Jack Abramoff and a host of other rather influence-peddling, semi-corrupt people that ply their trade at trying to get people to do things, get politicians very specifically to do things. I guess that music means time for me to go, right? Thanks to everybody in the booth, Trent, Chris Lopresto, Dave, Brendan, and of course John Crimmings as well. We'll be back to do it all again on Monday. I'll be by myself. Marin's here Tuesday. Have a good day. Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.